This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers, working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and joining me for the 149th episode of One Heat Minute, the podcast that impacts Michael Mann's LA 1995 crime opus Heat, is an experienced podcaster and talker. We just before jumped on air, talked about a three-hour breakdown Mission Impossible podcast that he did as part of his podcast.
Three and a half hours.
Jesus. Well, that is an effort in and of itself. His podcast, amongst others, is The Watch and Talk. He is occasionally at Mandatory and THR and really recaps the entire Mission Impossible series beautifully. That's his most recent post that I've read on THR that I just really loved. And also, more importantly than anything that happens on this show, is an ultimate Heat fan and reached out and said, Blake, I'd love to come on the show and talk to you about it. So I'm very pleased that we've been able to make it work. This man.
Yeah, I think you had one of my Twitter friends on there, and they shared it, and I was like, what, this guy's breaking down minute by minute? And, you know, it wasn't until I broke down, until I, like, watched my minute that I was like, oh, man, there's, like, 5 minutes right now until he gets to Wayne Grove. Yep. And I'm like, you're going to be talking about Winger right now for the next, like, you know, several weeks or whatever, just for this one little, like, build up to it. So I didn't really think about the task for that. But anyway, thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. And sorry, his name is Dylan Shark. Dylan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, Heat is in my top five of all time. It is a masterpiece. It's a movie, one of those movies I would not change any second of or any minute of. And I'm sure you've come across that when breaking it down minute by minute.
Yeah, I think there are definitely folks who have contrary opinions to me. But the more that I've held this minute up to scrutiny, and in-depth scrutiny too, I think like minute for minute, pound for pound, I wouldn't change a frame, to be brutally honest. I don't know how – I love that, you know, although Mann is infamous for tinkering with movies after release and multiple versions and – cut here, a trim there, or whatever. I think Heat is the least tinkered with, and that's saying something. You know, that's
yeah. It just came off Netflix. Did you realize that
in the United States? Really? No, I didn't.
It literally just came off in the last 2 weeks because we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, and you assigned me my minute, and I was like, okay. And I watched it a couple of weeks ago, and I watched all of it a couple of weeks ago, just rewatched it, and then the other night I was like, oh, I got to go look at that minute again, and it was gone. So then I popped over to Vudu. I'm like, I can't believe I don't own this on Vudu already. So I bought it, so I went to go buy it, and they only had the director's cut the director's definitive edition. But you smartly gave screenshots for the beginning and ending of the minute, and it's almost in the same place. I think it's maybe 30 seconds off.
It's synced up to a point, and then it diverts. Like it diverges, yeah. And then it's sort of a bit weird. But you know, it's. I've seen in the cinema during this project, I saw the director's definitive edition that came to Australia in a festival run. And then one of our really cool sort of, the Randwick Ritz in Sydney is one of those theaters that like plays things on 35mm whenever they get a chance. It's like a little boutique theater. And so I've seen the film on 35mm, which is the Warner Brothers Blu-ray version. And I've seen the 4K cut, which is the director's definitive edition. And to be brutally honest, the 35mm is just exquisite. Like it was maybe because the print was exquisite and I knew that it was about 24 years old at the time, but I was watching it and I was like, oh, this is exquisite. Like I wouldn't have changed a frame. Just clean it up, you know, post it on there on 4K and then just live with it. It didn't need any tinkering in my mind. Not a whisker.
You know, I realized also when looking through this is, you know, Robert De Niro and Al Pacino were such established actors, obviously, when this movie came out.
Yes.
I just now looked, and Al Pacino was just as far away from Heat now as he was from The Godfather at the time.
Yep.
It's exactly 24 years.
It is indeed.
And
the Irishman.
It's right. It's just I don't know. It's really crazy like how much time has passed out. Because when Heat first came out, I saw this when I was 10 years old. I saw this when the movie first came out. I had my aunt worked in.
We just discovered that we are the same age, and I would literally watch it. I think maybe a year after you watched it.
Yeah, my aunt was in product placement for movies, so she got screeners for some reason, and she would just send them to me. And it was for some reason the VHS release of this movie was one was a single VHS, but the screener that was sent was one of those two VHS ones. So I think they had original versions of it that had two VHSs, and then later they were able to – they increased the technology of VHS to be able to fit it into one. But I remember it, you know, as a kid, whenever you see a two VHS movie, you know it's an epic, right? Because like,
yes,
it was like Braveheart and Godfather and like, you know, these big epic movies, you know, Lawrence of Arabia and stuff like that. So I remember being, you know, pretty excited about it. And I remember also being a kid explaining the end of the movie to my mom and like getting emotional when I told her about it. And also
Please tell me that conversation.
Well, my mom was like, why are you getting so emotional right now? We were like on a road trip and I was like, because they're friends. And he like reaches out and he holds his hand out as he's dying. It's like, you know, as a kid, you don't understand this movie.
No.
You can't understand this movie. As a 10-year-old kid.
Unfathomable.
I didn't get the William Fichtner story, the Van Sant story at all. No idea what that was all about, but yep. I just knew he wanted to kill that guy, and I knew Wayne Grow was super bad, but I didn't really know what he had done that was that bad. Even though, you know, as I realized in this rewatch, the whole movie is because of Wayne Grow. The whole problem with everything. He never would have even gotten involved if Wayne Grow hadn't shot that cop at the very beginning of the movie.
Yep.
Like Al Pacino never would have even been exposed to Neil McCauley if he just hadn't that one second just been like, you know, just pulled the trigger and murdered a guy.
Yeah, the robbery homicide is the element, right? Is the element of right. Like once it's a homicide, it goes into Vincent's purview. And you think right. That maybe it would have been one of those highline burglaries that would have maybe come across their desk. They're going, hey, this crew took down this armored car. You know, no one was killed, but they're ghosts, like they're in the wind. They took Barabons, that's it. And so Vincent right. might have said, I'll leave it with them. They're right. good, but leave it with them. Or no, keep it on right. our radar. But
not important. Not important.
Not as
I wouldn't have even known there was a robbery homicide division specifically for murders while yes. stealing from people. And I also think, how many robbery homicide people does LA have? You know, like 10, or do they have 100, or like?
Well, isn't it the most famous bank robbery city in the world?
I guess.
According to the preamble in Den of Thieves, which can totally be trusted at this point.
Right. Den of Thieves, yeah. I listened to the episode with you and Courtney Howard, who's one of my buddies, and you guys talked about Den of Thieves a lot.
A lot.
But yeah, I wonder how that goes. But anyway, I saw this as a kid, and it's one of the movies, as I've grown, I've been able to revisit and understand in new ways.
Yeah.
So it's been a part of my growing process as watch, because I don't know how I sat through a 3-hour movie as a 10-year-old kid and was super riveted, but this movie's riveting even if you don't understand the side plots that's going on. Like, I didn't understand who John Voight's character was. I didn't understand what was going on with, you know, with, again, Van Sant and Wayne Grove, really, to be honest. And I also didn't understand the complexities of their family lives. But
when you take it back, that's the brilliant thing, is like, even pre-family, post-family, you know, every, you know, I think there's plenty of really great features that have come from film critics reappraising how they've grown with movies, you know, over the years and different stages of their life and what they can mean, and like real enduring pieces of art. You know, people talk about it with, you know, in literary criticism, people have talked about it for centuries, you know, talked about how like a great book is just a revisitable thing. It is to dive back into that headspace, into the vernacular, into the intonation, into the voices that are in your head, into accessing those parts. And so you read, you know, seminal books when you're a young age and you go back to them. There's certain, I don't know, there's like synapses that fire the same way as when you're a young person, and then there's synapses that you know, open up into wholly new things. You know, you can appreciate the craft a bit better. You can appreciate the, you know, things that are a little bit blunter and a little bit more simplified. Right. If it's aimed at a simple person, like simple kids, you know, like they're trying not to have anything too ambivalent or opaque for a young reader or whatever.
But and yeah. I bet if I watch this movie in 10 years, there's going to be new things that I uncover from it too.
100%.
Right. Like new ways to encounter it. Like, right. It's like it's not like right now I'm like, oh, I have figured out everything I'm ever going to think about Heat at this up to this point in my life.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll ever really happen for me. So I think that it'll always be something worth revisiting.
And look, you're a podcaster too, and so you understand. Excuse me, as someone who, like, you know, would regularly interact with folk and interview people and things like that, is one of the pure joys of this show, just as talking to you, is it's literally being able to bring people on the show who have completely different lenses to me, who've gone through different experiences, right, who come from different backgrounds. And so I feel like I've gotten the luxury to look through different shades of glasses as I'm watching, in different perspectives and different viewpoints, you know, even if I don't necessarily agree with them.
You're like a taxi driver that only talks about Heat.
That's exactly what I am.
With his passengers, because he just gets exposed to so many different people that have so many different things going on. And you're just like, hey, so have you guys seen Heat? And they're like, what? This taxi driver wants to talk about Heat. But yeah,
I just found my new Twitter bio. Thank you.
Yeah. So anyway.
Oh, that's brilliant. Well, look.
You know, also, and this it kind of will segue into to our minute, because we haven't even started our minute or anything. But I think the thing I love about this movie that makes it stand out so differently from other movies is, obviously, this movie has, you know, an anti-hero in Robert De Niro or in Neil McCauley. And, you know, I think most people are viewing this movie are going to like him better than Vincent Hanna. But
yes,
the thing is, this movie doesn't editorialize at all. It's like a documentary. It's you know, and it really feels like a documentary in the fact that they use the telescopic lens so often. It looks like you are every time you see a character, it looks like you're viewing in from a telescope or from binoculars from far away.
Yes.
And that's because the director is staying out of it. He's like, this is, you know, who you like better and who you're rooting for is none of my business. I'm just presenting you with what the characters are doing, and you can make up your own minds about it. And while I think people are still going to be lean toward it, I don't think he's holding our hands to Neil McCauley. I think that he's letting us find our own way to the characters that we love.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. I think it's a real art to and it's, you know, it's a great thing to hypothesize about, you know, the quintessential and Oscar-winning example of, like, anti-heroism in sort of the modern context, or that you know that follows bad guys, is sort of Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. You know, these guys are fundamentally bad, and you know the white hat that is following them is this wraith, is out there, is a shadow, and they sort of have that pervasive sense that he's always coming, is always sort of there, but to balance the same level of empathy that you have with each character, even though you're not editorializing exactly as you said, like in a more documentary sense, you're staying out of the bad shit that they do. Like, Michael Mann doesn't sugarcoat what I think is one of the gnarliest lines ever said in a movie, which is like, I tell you what I don't do, I don't sell medals. Like, you know, like, yeah, I've just been watching you all day murder people on the television, but you're as glib as, I tell you what I don't do, I don't sell medals. You know what I mean? So, like, it's I think it's a real mastery that this movie achieves, that you are totally on the side of both of them at the same time.
And it's funny is also, I think part of the thing that is so abrasive about Al Pacino, among many things, is he, you know, I think there's a lot of people that that speculate that he's a drug addict. But his random screaming, like, he's, she got a great ass, and the give me what you got. Give me what you got. Like, that scene with Hank Azaria, I saw an interview with him recently where he said they were doing takes over and over and over again. Michael May. I combined Michael Bay and Michael Mann right there. Way different. Completely different. But
a different movie directed by Michael Bay.
Right. He did the take over and over and over again. And then finally, out of nowhere, he was doing it calmly. He was just like, 'cause she got a great ass. And out of nowhere, he screamed in his face. And that was a surprise for Hank Azaria. He didn't expect it. And that's what, like, that's the take that they ended up using. And it was because he was genuinely surprised that he's got his face screamed in. So I just love those random scream moments from Al Pacino's character that makes him very, unlikable in some ways also.
Yeah, unlikable maybe, but unpredictable. I think it's all with intent.
Unpredictable.
What's beautiful, it's all with intent. Every one of those is an interrogation. This is what I often say.
Right.
You're doing, like me, I've seen this movie many times over many years, and so you sort of get to it, and you're like, when you're piecing it together, you find whole viewings. It's like, I'm just going to watch the shit out of Vincent, or I'm just going to watch the shit out of Neil. I'm just going to watch Chris Chehalis. I just, like, that's the person that I want to vibrate with on this viewing. I want to really hone in on them. And one of the things that I think you talk about is, like, in isolation, you might find Vincent more abrasive or more silly or whatever. But like when you look at it, it's like when he's being silly, he's trying to displace people. He's trying to grate with them. He wants to keep them uncomfortable. He wants to make sure that they can't track what he's actually thinking and feeling on this manic energy. And the shock value is great. Like that works in all of his interrogations. You know, from Albert Torino and then the brothers Torino and then you know Hank Azaria and you know in every person.
And poor Ralph.
Oh, Ralph! Ralph gets a sliver of it. Ralph gets Ralph. Sit down, and like he gets that great one.
Sit down. Yeah. Xander Berkeley is great. There's also it's all so funny. Every single side character is a household name if you've watched enough TV or movies, and where everything from Natalie Portman, who's an Oscar winner, to William Fichtner. It's crazy that Michael T. Williamson from was Bubba Gump the year before this.
Yeah.
And he seems so much older in this, obviously, because he plays a character that's a little more mature. But anyway.
No, and just before we get into the minute, just in case folks haven't had a chance to listen, there's a wonderful interview. They did an anniversary screening of Heat when they collated this director's definitive edition and made it to 4K. And it's a big panel session with Christopher Nolan in the host's chair. And he talks to Michael T. Williamson about, you know, being in this movie. And the one thing was they'd actually cast someone to play Sergeant Drucker already. And when he didn't get an Academy Award nomination or a win for Forrest Gump, which is the year before, Michael Mann and Al Pacino made it their personal like goal to get him in the movie. They're like, this guy was freaking great. Like he was essential to that movie that won a stack of Oscars. He didn't even get a nomination. That's just outlandish. So they paid the guy out who that had cast and cast Drucker, cast him as Michael T. Williamson, the legendary Michael T. Williamson, who's just incredible, and then goes on to work with Mann again.
You know, also like the random cameo that I definitely noticed this rewatch was Jeremy Piven as the doctor.
Piven's great.
Out of nowhere.
Piven's great.
And also the lawyer from Jurassic Park, Gennaro.
Yes.
He's the construction clerk at the very beginning of the movie.
And he knows that Chris is up to something.
He's suspicious.
He's suspicious right from the outset. He knows there's something wrong. He knows he's got all the papers. He's like, there's something wrong about this, but I'm going to let you go. But look, Dylan, in the spirit of great episodes and great guests, we haven't even talked about the minute yet. So we're going to – what Dylan and I are going to do right now.
I'll blame myself for that one.
No, this has happened many times. What I'll do is Dylan and I are now going to watch the minute together, the 149th. Minute of Michael Mann's 1995 Crime Opus Heat. We're going to watch that right now. Then we're going to come back and unpack it with you guys and talk more things, all things Heat.
Yeah, this is room service. Jameson ordered a BLT and they screwed up his room number. Could you give it to me, please?
Always doing that.
Yeah, I know.
1735.
Thank you.
Dang, so many of them have just perfect ending points, don't they? Just sometimes they just end perfectly. Like
I was just going to say right then, you know, for folks who are only listening, you get a sort of a concept in the beginning of this minute. If we're talking about it just as like a mini vignette, you get this great establishing shot of the outside of the Airport Hilton. You get De Niro going inside, and this is where you sort of know that that great phrase, you know, have we had any Highline burglaries that have mystified us? You know, this guy just knows how to get into places and make himself seem anonymous. He walks straight into the service entrance, straight up to the phone, calls room service, and gets the information about Jameson, aka Wayne Grove, straight away. Like, hey, Jameson ordered BLT, someone screwed up the room number, and, you know, yeah, they're always doing that. Yeah, yeah. Really casual, just like beautifully embodies the character of anybody you could talk to 1,000 times in the hotel.
And while he's doing that also, he's scoping out like room service costumes, right, or like uniforms right next to it.
Right next to him. He does it one-on-one. And then the minute ends with, once he does that and you're like, Jesus, this guy's good. Like, again, it's just one of those appraisal moments where you're like, this guy's phenomenal and he's not going to be stopped. Has a great little moment where the guys in the hotel who are watching over Wayne Grove and Jameson are just having a couple of cigarettes, blowing smoke rings and just playing cards. Like, there is no chance that this guy's going to be there. Vincent's already made the call, you know, about 10 minutes ago now in the sequence of the film, that it's very unlikely he's going to be back. But the final, the beautiful sort of pièce de résistance of this minute before we get to the 150th is this wave of emotion and realization that just sort of pours over Edie's face as she starts to realize she's sitting in the car and like, why, and sorry to be so brazen with saying it, but why the fuck am I here? Like, this is what is
going through some serious doubts and trust issues right now.
Oh yeah, and
it's like finally,
like she should be. Like, this is like the moment where she should be having these trust issues and panic moment.
I mean, she probably should have had them way before this. Also,
but even more so. Like, why would he do the detour?
Caught up in the romance. She was caught up in the romance, and I think a lot of people can relate with that. Where you get caught up with somebody that in a heated moment of passion, and you know that difference between when your feet touch the ground and you kind of snap back to reality.
Yes.
And this is exactly what's happening. This is the credits rolling at the end of the. Like, if this is a romantic or a romance movie, the credits would have rolled just before she made this face.
Yeah.
Right? That's when people ride off in the sunset together or whatever. Like, that's the thing about it. But do you watch Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul?
I haven't seen much of Better Call Saul, but I did go through Breaking Bad. I've been all the way through. I did Breaking Bad in like a massive binge. And right. I called it Breaking Blake at the time because literally I was just like, I was in Walter's headspace. I haven't watched Better Call Saul, but I've heard that it's incredible. So I'm kind of like, I haven't made space for a binge yet, but it sounds great.
So I do I do a podcast about Better Call Saul called Better Talk Saul.
Oh, great.
And I talk about this a lot during the show, and it's during a lot of Mike scenes because Mike's character is really expanded upon.
Yes.
Mike from Breaking Bad is really expanded upon in Better Call Saul, and it's a prequel that takes place before. But there's a term I always like to use, and that's competence porn.
Yes.
Where it shows him going around and you don't know what he's doing. You just see him taking a step by step, doing things very competently. He doesn't stop to look around. He doesn't like question what he's doing, fiddle with things. He just grabs a tool, uses it, puts the tool down, goes to the next thing, extremely competent. And that's exactly what we see from Robert De Niro here. He doesn't sneak. He moves very quickly. He acts like he knows what he's doing. He makes a call, grabs the uniform. He's just slyly going through here and navigating through this in a way that I wouldn't, even if I wasn't doing something illegal, I wouldn't be able to navigate around a hotel this easily.
That is an all-timer observation. I just want to say that, guys. Competence porn is exact. That is like... That is a Michael Mannion essential to all of these, a bunch of characters and so many.
The reloading from Val Kilmer that's super famous from this movie. He should have gotten an Oscar just for the reloading scene.
Remember this, Dylan. We've skated past the Oscars. I'm just going to take another quick moment talking to you about it. We've skated past the Oscars many times talking about, you know, whatever anyone says about it, it's really incredible for a film and for a filmmaker and for a performer to receive that kind of recognition from their peers. Like, it's amazing. Like, whatever else we say about it and the elevation that it gives to a movie. This movie that has 70 speaking roles, that is like $100 million in today's money, action epic with some of the greatest actors who've ever lived, and like another filmmaker who's like a juggernaut filmmaker, maverick, incredible person, LA set, ambitious thing, wasn't nominated for an Oscar. Not one.
It was nominated for an MTV Movie Award, though, for Val Kilmer.
You know what? So got that. I was wrong. I was wrong. Some accolades mean more than others.
It got the recognition it deserved.
But no, competence.
No, but I agree. But competence. But I say
porn,
90.
Competence porn, though, is such a. It's such an underrated, and yet essential thing, to just demonstrate, like, to say things about a character without having to make really laborious exposition all the time.
Right. Right.
And so it's a great shorthand.
Shows Mike doing that. A lot of times, we don't even know what the end result is.
Yes.
And that's what's happening in this scene. We know he's going for Wayne Girl, but we don't know what he's doing. It's not like some set out plan that we know how they're going to execute it.
Yeah.
We just trust that he knows what he's doing because he's acting like he knows what he's doing. So as viewers are watching it, being like, this is – it pumps endorphins in your head when you see somebody doing something so competently. And that's something that, again, like that's what's happening in this sequence. That's what happens a lot with Mike's character.
So, Dil, I don't know if you noticed, like a few years ago, that like, and it sort of happened in the Australian tennis season. You know, you're talking about competency porn before. They started to bring in these super slow motion cameras, and very particularly started focusing on like one of the greatest tennis players of all time, like Roger Federer. And I'm not like a huge tennis guy or anything like that, but I just remember. They used to, in all the promos for all the ads in the Australian Open in January, they just kept playing over and over again these slow motion shots of him doing backhands. And it was this crazy, like, balletic, insane movement where you could see his muscles rippling. You see him, like, he's rehearsed this movement, you know, 10,000 times. And you're seeing it in ultra slow motion. And I think it's like, that was like, a sports version of competency porn. Like, look at this guy who has this motion, even one shot of a cache of shots.
Or like something you'd see in like Planet Earth or something like that animals like that in super slow mo.
That's exactly like, it's really like, accurate. It's like that lizard. It's like that lizard who escapes the snake pit in the most recent like Planet Earth.
Right.
It's like it's right. So unbelievable. You're like, I didn't know a body could move like that, or I didn't know someone could get to that level. So it's like that's one of those things that I think Heat does so unbelievably, and I think is like an underrated commodity in movies when you're just shown that someone's really good at something. And in the most overt ways, you see it in like really fun popcorn movies like the Oceans movies and heist movies in general. They feel like a genre that's really ripe for it. But I just – like I love what you said there about Heat just does it over and over again. And you were talking more about Better Call Saul as a prequel. But I just remember being mesmerized by it and something that completely sticks in my head. And now when you're saying it, I'm like you can start to see that – I don't know if people are as overtly aware of what they're doing when they show you it, but I like that's what makes now tennis memorable for me. And Federer is like when I see him do a backhand, I can only imagine the super slow-mo Planet Earth, you know, version of him doing that.
Also, in a scene like this, right, it's like a puzzle, right?
Mm.
And, you know, without even realizing it, your brain is trying to put it together. So like when you're seeing him doing something like this, you're like, okay, what's he doing? Okay. All right, he's making a call right now. He says he ordered a BLT, lost the room number. Okay, he's trying to find the room number. Okay, how is he going to do this? And you're not like out loud saying it, but you're trying to figure out what they're doing while it's going on. And it's a fun puzzle for your brain. It's like an intellectual puzzle for you to try to start figuring out what they're doing because it's not spelling it out right in front of you. You pretty much figure that he's going to get Wayne Grow because in the car on the way there, he looks unsettled, right? He's just like, I got this itch that I need to scratch. Ah, we got time. And that ends up being his undoing completely.
I love that. It's the itch he's got to scratch. I wonder if we pull those faces when you've got like an itch in the middle of your back that you can't reach. You're just
like Wayne Grow. Freaking Wayne Grow. I mean, sorry, I have an itch. Sorry. It's about his sense of justice too, right? Like, it's funny is that whole idea that are you able to drop everything in 30 seconds flat when you see the Heat coming around the corner?
Yes.
And, you know, it's interesting because with Edie, he was able to. He was able to walk away from her. And it wasn't about the people in his life necessarily. It was a sense of justice. He was like, this guy, Wingro, he needs to freaking die. And you know, that's what he gets caught for. It's just the fact that he needs that. Or, you know, I don't know if some people would call it justice, some people call it revenge. But I look at it more as justice than revenge.
I think in your mind, like, so objectively we can say it's vengeance. You know, it's revenge for him being an imposition to everything that they've done so far. It's revenge for the heat that he brings about on them. It's revenge for the deaths of, you know, most directly Treo. It's revenge for the tip off to the cops. But in Neil's mind,
or also even that killing that cop at the beginning that didn't deserve to die.
Yeah, all of like, those. It's the whole suite of those things. Like, we can objectively say it's revenge, but I think
because he doesn't seem to ever kill anybody that he doesn't need to, right? He's not a psycho like Wayne Grove is just this.
But I think the psychotic nature of Neil is in that for him, none of it is revenge. It is balance. Like, it is justice in his mind. Like, right. Nothing that he's doing, he's like, I've got more motivation to kill this person. You know, it's like, I love the phrasing there. Like, to go back to another minute, it's like, I've got more motivation to kill Van Zandt than, like, anyone here, right? His crew.
Right.
And do you have more motivation to kill Van Zandt than the crew? Because, like, oh, yes, the assassin was going to kill you as an individual, but you had the whole crew there to stop them, right? So I think it's that whole, like, in his mind, you're a businessman.
Restoring balance. I like that.
Yeah, it's the balance of we are criminal businessmen. You should know that my motivation was not personal. And Van Zandt takes it personal, so he takes it personal. And with Wayne Grow, it's you've now added heat on us, so the balance is you've got to go. And so, you know, Van Zandt was always.
If he just hadn't done that, he would have gotten away. And that really bums me out because he's a guy just. I wish. I feel like he deserved to survive this movie, and you know that's not how things worked in the situation.
Yeah, it's one of those things where the genius of this movie is that on these two parallel train tracks of Vincent and Neil, our co-protagonists, you always are on both of their sides. In any given moment, whenever they're on screen, you're like, you want Neil to get away. You want Neil to make the decision that adheres to his discipline. Like, that's what I feel like that's what we're constantly reinforced to do. And
because Val Kilmer is able to in this movie. He is able to walk away. To see his mentor not be able to.
I think one thing I want to bring up with you around that is, you know, if you look at the awesome. If you guys have had a chance to listen, and hopefully you have had a chance to listen to the previous episode 140 with Joe Grabinski. This is 149. If it's your first episode, welcome. Thank you so much for listening to One Heat Minute. But if you go back, one thing that Joe and I talked about was, you know, even though Chris gets away, you know, I can't remember what phrase.
He doesn't really get away. Right?
He doesn't like get away.
He escapes jail, but he doesn't. Like, escape, like, he's not going to be happy or anything, right?
Like, Joe used the phrase sheer devastation. Like, and I think that look on his face when Charlene cuts him loose, you know, if the sun rises and sets with her, his life is in disarray. Like, who the hell knows where Chris goes from here? And so when I look at his face, I'm like, yeah, he got away. But, you know, I feel like if Neil left Edie and did get away in this movie, I don't think Neil's as beat up about it as having to leave Edie, because the discipline has been reinforced time.
Well, Edie was a fantasy, right? It's a fantasy of this non-lonely existence that he thinks that this storybook that he'll be able to live in that he probably wouldn't have been able to anyway, right?
I think
do you think they would have been together forever?
No, I think in an earlier episode, and I love to credit the awesome guests on the show, but like, I think Manola Dargis called Edie the postcard from Collateral. Like, that's what she is. She's that fantasy land. She's the embodiment of that fantasy land. She's what he thinks he needs at that time. But, you know, after all of this, like, hair trigger, impulse, competency, perfection, like, how does Neil go to New Zealand and be bored? Like, how does he not do things? Like, that idle hands of the devil placing. Like, how – if he gets away, he's coming back. Like, he may not come back to L.A. But, like, right. What's to stop him from going to Chicago? What's to stop him from going to New York, reestablishing?
Oh, he's going to get in touch with John Voight's character again at some point and try to pick up jobs somewhere.
He hooks up with Nate or a proto-Nate in another town, starts making moves himself, Highline burglaries, makes a crew. You know, it's like this is the thing that's kept him – that's made him be able to survive and stay out of jail. But it just seems like unconscionable to me for him to be that free and not to be a slave to this program that he's constantly having to reinforce.
Well, also when we talk about in that same vein of Val Kilmer, right? You know, not really getting away, even though he gets away, right? He escapes jail, but that doesn't mean he doesn't, you know, he's not punished, right?
Yes.
It's like in that vein, did Neil lose and Vincent win? Because I don't think Vincent really necessarily won, right? It's not like Vincent's looking off into the, you know, into the airport with the lights and being like, oh, nice, my completed life, like things are going well for me right now and stuff like that, right? Because he's also sacrificed everything for this as well.
Yeah, I think.
And Neil's pain is done, right? Neil's pain is done.
There's a way that, you know, it's in the immediate way. Like, let's just say, I don't know. Let's just say there's a hard cut to credits immediately after Vincent shoots Neil. Like, let's just say, like, imagine an existence where that happened. It would be a completely different ending to this movie.
Because the movie would be different.
Yeah, the whole movie's different. Because in that moment, it's kind of validating that Vincent is punishing Neil, that Neil deserved this punishment. And I think a lesser film is like, the good guy beats the bad guy deserved to die. And it's sort of this... Right. And this movie, I think, is elevated in your and my conceptions and in everyone who's listening to this show and all the wonderful guests is because the last thing that it does is not that. It makes us right. – we've been viewing, you know, realistically from – I'm just going to go, like, try and find the exact minute of where it sort of started. It's like – it's almost back at, like – the 112th minute, and you and I are now talking about the 149th. It's like at the midway point of this movie, and like 2 hours in is the heist. Like we're seeing the fallout. It's almost now consistently like 37 minutes, nearly 40 minutes of all fallout. And so even right. even at the crescendo of the movie that we're referencing at that airport, it doesn't get it. Like neither of these guys are going to get away scot-free from this. Like Neil has had to abandon Edie, so she's gone. Even if he does get away from Vincent or does, you know, the tables have turned and he shoots Vincent and he gets away, is his cover blown? There's no way he's staying in LA. Very highly likely that he's going to get caught anyway. If he doesn't get caught, he's gone. Edie's gone. Chris is gone. He's permanently hunted in the United States. You know, so
what I was going to say is also, right, like that conversation they had, which is just a brilliant conversation. I almost wish I was there for that minute, even though that was several minutes, I'm sure. The conversation they have in the diner, where he says, you know, he's not going to go back to jail, and at the end he doesn't, because I think that would have been a worse punishment than ever, right? Like he is.
It's freedom or death.
It was like almost a respectful happenstance that Al Pacino gets the drop on him because. That was a coin toss that who was going to survive that, but it was it's not like when he was sitting there lying on his dying, he it's not like he picks up his gun and really wants to kill Vincent. He doesn't have any ill will toward Vincent at all. Like his sense of justice isn't toward him, right? It's toward although it is toward Wingrove. So killing him is not a crime to him, as opposed to what Wingrove did is a crime.
Yes,
right, like.
I agree. It's like Vincent, him facing off with Vincent is like a occupational hazard, right? It's like you do what you do, I do what I got to do. Like, you know, there's a flip side to that coin. You do got me boxed in. Like that whole exchange, you know, there's.
And also imagine if Vincent or, you know, Neil killed Vincent at the end of the episode, or the end of the movie.
Yes.
Like, I feel like the whole way I look at the movie would be different. And I feel like that's the way that they had to do it. They had to end the character you liked better, or at least I liked better. But I feel like most people like Neil better because he's the antagonist, but he's the, I don't know. He has a,
It is a weird thing.
The more likable character.
It is a weird thing in this movie because I think it's a flip of a coin for everyone in this movie to who they love. And I genuinely, over the 2 years of this project, have flipped, you know. Like, sometimes I've been so near, like, just because of it's De Niro's craft and his, like, magnetism. And there's, like, this weird allure that he has in Silence. You know, it makes him one of the greatest actors who's ever lived. Like, the camera loves him in close-up, not saying a word. And so this movie has large chunks of that. Like, Michael Mann as a filmmaker has a hyper-awareness of what, you know, what we as the audience want from De Niro and what De Niro's, like, strengths are. You know, Michael Mann famously, one of his top 10 movies of all time is Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull. And, you know, Marty does better in that movie just with movement and action and ferocity with De Niro's face in close-up and black and white. It's just, you know, the composition, it's unbelievable, right? And it's emotional and fantastic. And so I think that there's a whole reading of this movie where you like the cool antagonist, conflicted, ambivalent. And, you know, if you're not a Pacino fan, you know, or if you like De Niro more just even as an actor and a performer and his body of work, you kind of lean towards Neil all the time. But I find myself constantly in awe of all the things, the selfless nature of Pacino's performance here, because Pacino has, you know, more exposition. He's got more exposition stuff. He's leaning into more of that dialogue-driven sort of stuff. He's a bit more of a grating character in some ways, and especially in his interrogations, he's got to be manic and crazy to keep people off
guard. Don't waste my motherfucking time!
Like, yes, like all these interrogations, but I, like, love that. Like, the more I've watched this film with an audience, I just marvel at Pacino too. So I completely agree. The movie has to end the way that it ends. And in reference to our very specific minute, it's like, despite the fact that we're getting this competence porn, we're getting this, like, we're watching the work of a cold-blooded sociopath. He's so good at just murdering people and then walking away like nothing. Like, he literally walked up to Van Zandt's house, murdered him, left. Wango, murder, left. Like, he's good. Beats a cop half to death.
You know the best part of the most...
Yeah, go. Sorry, go.
The most pleasing part of finally killing Wayne Grow is that look at me.
Yeah,
look at me. Like, who wrote? Like who thinks of that? Right? Like, who thinks to say, "Look at me. I want you to look at me in the eyes. Yes. I don't want to say anything to you. I don't want to chew you out. I just want you to be looking in my eyes and realizing I'm the one that's killing you. I want my face to be the last thing you see before you die." Like,
it is fucking cold-blooded. It's
right. Fucking that cold-blooded. I think that has to be, like, one of the top cold-blooded murder scenes in any movie I've seen.
You can't. I don't want you to, even for 1 second, be able to not realize that I'm dealing out your death.
Right. Yes. It is me. I want, like, you know, what was that? In that movie Wild Wild West, there's the idea that the last frame that you see is burned into your eyeball so they can put a projector in your freaking head.
I never thought in this podcast, we've had some digressions. We've had some wild digressions. But to get to Wild Wild West from here, yeah. I need to clap.
Wild Wild West. That's where it always goes. But also, another thing I want to say too, when we're talking about Vincent's character, because we're talking about this, and I really truly think that Mike from Breaking Bad, I feel like, was pulled straight from Neil McCauley. Yes. His sense of justice is the same, his competence the same, his loneliness and how little he talks and all that kind of stuff is all kind of – I really think he was derived from Neil McCauley more than anything. I don't have any actual evidence on that, but I think next time I get an interview with one of those guys, I need to bring that up. But that scene where we first meet Vincent Hanna and he's going there at the crime scene of that heist of the armored car, right? He's walking around and also we see that competence porn. He is figuring out everything. He just arrives on the scene. They've already been there for maybe hours, and he figures out things immediately that other people didn't, right? Like, he's immediately pointing out the professionals. They know our time. They did this. And then I also love when he said somebody kills one of them and one of the cops, and you know, they didn't want it, you know, they didn't want to kill anybody.
Why leave a living witness?
Right.
Why leave a living witness? These guys went rock
and
roll.
What difference does it make?
Yeah.
He said, once you killed one, what, it's already escalated robbery or homicide. What difference does it make? And also thinking back to that scene when, after he kills one of them, they look at each other and he just makes a nod. And like, and Vincent Hanna figures all that out in 2 seconds. And that was just another, just showing that these two people are as competent as could be at their jobs. We're watching heavyweights in this. And that's what,
it's that whole thing. It's that whole thing. It's like watching a professional do anything.
Yeah.
You know, versus, versus someone who does it as a vocation. Like, you know, like Vincent walks in and he's just pointing to elements for explanation. TV man, called a guard slick. This guy, bang, you know, I can't get over Ted Levine. He's like, bang, 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 close quarters, cool, points to the, and then Vincent's.
In Barabah.
they got 1.1 million in Barabahs and they ignore the loose cash. I just like Ted Levine. Freaking legend.
And this is only what, 4 years after he played Buffalo Bill in South of the Lambs. That's also crazy that anyway.
Yeah, and
he
and
gets a brutal death too. Dead Levine's character. I think it even shows like some of his skull outside of his head after he gets shot in the head or something like that. Like he's really in this movie.
He's Ted Levine. Two things about Ted Levine's character in this movie is Bosco. Number one, Michael Mann offered him Wayne Grove. Because Michael Mann has a, like, for folks who don't realize, is, you know, he had a huge, he did Manhunter, and the folks, Dino De Laurentiis, who owns the rights to Thomas Harris's Hannibal trilogy, actually offered him to do Silence of the Lambs after he'd done Manhunter, and he said no, and then it obviously went,
Jonathan Demme.
Went to Jonathan Demme, the legend Jonathan Demme, and created, you know, that masterpiece that is Silence of the Lambs, but Michael Mann didn't want to do that. And similarly, you know, at the time, I think he wanted to cast Ted Levine because he'd seen Silence of the Lambs and was a huge fan. Yeah, was like,
that would have really worked. I'm not going to lie. That would have worked.
Well, he wanted to cast Ted Levine as Wayne Grove.
I feel like...
So Michael Mann wanted to cast
Ted Levine. I'm saying that would have worked. If he did want to play Wayne Grove, I think totally. He could. I think I like the way it worked out, but that would have worked out. Let's
100%. But I think Ted Levine was like, please don't make me play another psychopath like I've just done.
Right.
So he's like, let me be a cop. But... also, Ted Levine has that death scene is maybe one of the most disturbing. The death mask that he has when he's dead and like his eyes are wide and wild and Vincent has to appraise his dead body. It's like that one. Talk about like, you know, the wild, wild west, last thing you're ever going to see images. Like that image of his death mask is a haunting one in this movie. But
it's interesting too, because in that chess game of this movie, it's interesting too, because that, you know, robbery heist, that big one that happens around the 2 hour mark, they trade the Ted Levine for the Tom Sizemore. And, you know, it seems like that hurts Macaulay more. Obviously he has more chess pieces. Vincent has more chess pieces, especially ones he can trust when half the thing he's doing is trying to kill one of the guys that betrayed them or whatever the case may be. Wait, but also now we've talked about other things besides the minute, and that's my fault completely. But I do want to say one thing too. When he is walking down that corridor into the hotel,
mm-hmm.
and again, he's just walking like he knows what he's doing, and that's all you got to really do if you want to get around, sneak around somewhere, right? You don't want to act like you're a fish out of water. But it's like, it's silent. And a lot of this movie has no score. But then he's walking in the hallway and then boom, the score just kicks in. Just like nonchalantly, the score just kind of kicks in once he's walking down there, just kind of informing the audience that the scene is getting more tense. And I love how it just kind of just kicks in and just starts playing while he's walking in the hallway, just being like, oh, the stakes are changing in this scene.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those great unconscious decisions as well, right? So you do it. And the fact that the score kicks in, and because it's been sparing with the score at certain times, right. It's like an immediate heart pump. Like you go, boom, oh, okay, here we go, something's going to happen. And so in some ways it kind of, it's very manipulative on like same as horror movies, right? You know, a horror movie will play the score when something tense is about to happen. But again, in Heat, it's like, okay, this is, you know, be prepared, things are going to happen. And a lot of times, like in this scene, and not to spoil the upcoming minutes and the discussions, but it's like, we think that Neil's like going to get caught.
Like we didn't already do that.
Like we didn't already. But the things we think that Neil's going to get caught, and Neil, as we know, like, he just goes through. Like, it's a longer, a higher, multi-tiered level of tension that's happening all the way through this minute, because really until, you know, we've still got about another 5 or 10 minutes before he actually gets to Wangaroo and the killing is done, we're sort of seeing all, we're seeing his motions, we're seeing him get through, we're seeing him making his way through the hotel, and then we cut over to Vincent, who starts to get some notifications that things are going down at the hotel, and he has to make a call whether he's going to leave Justine or stay. And as we know,
if he's going to walk away from the things that he loves when he feels the heat coming around the corner, kind of, right? Like,
yes,
which he does, right? He emphatically, finally, 100% leaves his wife in that scene, you know, you know, that's heartbreaking itself because they had the best moment they've had in the entire movie together. The closest and nicest they've been to each other, the sweetest they've been to each other just before they leave each other.
Yeah, that's the tragedy. And also the brave face. I think what's scary is that the brave face that Diane Venora's character puts on and says, yeah, no, I can do it. Go if you need to go. And Vincent sort of skips down the stairs and there's this sort of lonely wind instrument and she crumples when he leaves. Like, because she, you know, she knows the weight of, you know, a young daughter who's just committed suicide, a marriage that's just collapsed, and she's got to kind of be there. But she knew that, you know, that was her cutting him loose from their relationship, like, right then.
Right. Anyway, we covered all we could for this minute.
I was going to say, Dylan, I think you've done one of the all-timer quotes of competency porn. I love it. If you've already mentioned it on your other podcast, Watch and Talk, or your breakdown of Better Call Saul, I think that is, you know, that is enough to demonstrate exactly the kind of Michael Mann insight that we needed. So, firstly, Dylan, thank you for reaching out. Thank you for supporting the podcast, and thank you for being a part of the show.
Yeah, hopefully I can get you on my podcast review a movie sometime. We'll talk about it, and we'll try to figure out sometime.
Absolutely free to talk about it. And also, for folks who don't realize, I do occasionally review movies that don't take me 150 hours. So I can hopefully...
It's like when you're done with this, are you going to ever want to talk about Heat ever again? Like, are you just going to have every conversation you could possibly have? You had every single perspective of the movie you could possibly have, but somehow I feel like there's still going to be more to say.
I just think that right now, over to, because this is the other thing, right? You know this, you know, as a person who podcasts and as a film fan and as a writer and observer of things, it's like things grow in your conceptions and things change significantly in different periods of your life. And I feel like this entire project over 2 years has been amazing because of the different people that I've been able to talk to, your friend Courtney Howard, like, you know, all the amazing guests that have brought their lenses to it. I feel like I've been able to view it from a million different ways. But I'm happy. I don't know if I'll feel – I think I might feel sad when it's over as much as I feel satisfied. So, like, I think that, you know, when you've been able to pour over a piece of art like this and have, like, a lot of the opinions and be able to project and bounce things off other people and have people disagree with you. Like, people, you know, happily have said, you know, other Michael Mann films have done these themes better, or, you know, they might have crescendoed in this, but I think they're honed better when they're simpler, you know, epic.
And then you just drop them off the call and then you just say, see you later.
No. This is what, you know, this is part of the exercise, right? You want to scrutinize it and you want to hold it up. And so I think, you know, you called me a taxi driver that only talks about heat at the beginning of this episode. And I think at the end of it, I will have felt like I've had all the conversations, but the amazing people that have been following along on this show and the amazing people who have interacted and the amazing people that have contributed might still have more things to say. And so I'll always be here as the person who's has probably committed more time to this than any other person. So I'm more than happy to always talk about it. But no, I won't be doing any more follow-up podcasts for Michael Mann, existing Michael Mann movies.
You know what movie I think would be perfect for this also, besides that? Heat? Because the part of a Heat is there's so much going on in every scene, right? Everything is packed into it. And in my another movie, I this came to mind when I thought about this, is another one of my top five movies of all time, which is Atonement.
Atonement.
I feel like Atonement would be so, because that's a movie I think of when I think of every frame a painting.
Yes.
Because every frame of that movie is a painting. And not only to talk about the cinematography from it, but the complexities that happen throughout the movie. I thinking about you doing a podcast of every minute or something, I was like, you know, that's the – besides Heat, which I think is perfect for that, I think Atonement is another – it would be just like another perfect idea. I'm not suggesting you do that or anything.
I'm suggesting that you do it. I'm suggesting that the Atonement podcast, the perfect name for it.
If I launched it, you'd be my first guest. That's for sure.
I'd happily be a guest on the show. But yeah, look, there are I'm lucky, Dylan. I feel like Heat is the perfect movie for this, and there are some other fantastic and phenomenal movies that have minute by minute podcasts. But I genuinely think that, you know, they're rare bird. I think Atonement's a great film too. That's the rare birds that you can, and I feel like you very quickly, if you've taken the ethos as I have to get people who maybe don't agree with you all the time, you very quickly realize that like there is scrutiny to be had on every masterpiece, and I think that this is one that it's gotten to hear. But yeah, no more Michael Mann movies for me. Maybe another project on the horizon, but you guys will have to wait to hear about that. Ladies and gentlemen, please follow along. Dylan Shuck, thank you so much. At Shuckster, S-C-H-U-C-K-S-T-E-R on Twitter.
Don't forget that C. Don't forget that first C.
Don't forget the C. If you forget it, you will just be searching forever. Thewatchandtalk.com. You can find all of his other links. He's got some other links to some freelance work that he does as well. Thank you so much for being a part of the show, Dylan. And hopefully, yes, I'll definitely guest on there on your show. Just let me know a time and a place and I'll be there. Thank you, Mr. Garth Franklin, for our web design. Mr. Paul Davies for our theme. And we'll catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner.